Okay, hi, I'm Brian Cardell. I'm a developer advocate at Egalia.
And I'm Eric Meyer, also a developer advocate at Egalia. A lot of what we do is code. So we thought we'd have someone on who can talk about code. Please introduce yourself.
I didn't know we were going to talk about code. I'm really more of an amateur beekeeper. But I'm Matt Marquis. I have done some JavaScript in my day, among other things. And yeah, I think I could fake talk about code if you could hum a few bars.
I feel like you might be underselling yourself a little bit because you just launched a course about JavaScript, did you not?
That's exactly right. That is JavaScript for everyone with Piccalilli. And it is most of what I know about JavaScript in there. It is quite a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, that just launched. It has been, I'm sorry, I'm looking at a calendar because it's all sort of been a big blur since launch day. That has been 1 week so far.
Speaking of humming a few bars, it's been 1 week. Anyway, sorry.
Hey, it's been really great being on the show. I'll see you guys later.
Yeah. Right. Now we're going to cut that part. Where do people go to find it, by the way?
That is Piccalilli, which is next to impossible to spell unless you're from the UK or New England. WIL.TO/JS. That'll get you right there.
All right.
WIL.TO is Matt's website.
Yes. Yeah, I do have a website. That is worth mentioning, I think.
Yeah.
Sorely out of date. It does technically have a blog with a whopping two things on it.
Mm.
You know how it is. We all know how it is.
Yeah. I do know how it is. I'm lucky if I blog once a month these days. But for the folks at home who are watching along and maybe have not, for whatever bizarre cave-related reason, have never heard of you before, you know, what's your background that led you up to launching a course like this?
Yeah. A wizard put a curse on me.
Yeah.
Again, I live in the greater Boston area. So, you know, traffic incidents occur and I cut off a wizard and I am cursed to speak about JavaScript. I guess forever until I am one day freed. No, I don't know. I fell into this job in 2007-ish. Just got a mind for memorizing JavaScript, I suppose. So here I am with all this knowledge. I should say I'm not a capital D JavaScript developer day to day. You know, I'm putting borders on things for a living is the running joke. But I have historically fallen in with some pretty rough crowds, like the folks at Boku, who are top of the heap JavaScript folks. And you know, you absorb a lot of it and you end up memorizing specifications for various reasons. And then one day you wake up and there you are writing a course about JavaScript.
Yeah. So was this something you came up with or Andy came up with, or you were bouncing things off of each other?
Yeah. Andy did complete CSS a while back. We both did a course for the Chrome team for web.dev.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, he did one on CSS. I did two, like an absolute madman. I did one about images and I did one about JavaScript. And they're good.
Okay.
Ellipsis.
Images, you say?
Yep, images, that's right. Perhaps you've heard of them. Both courses are really dry. Like they're sort of it's formatted as like lessons and they're still sort of reference materials for web.dev. And I didn't want to do that. in the moment, perfectly fine. But JavaScript's weird and half broken and patently ridiculous a lot of the time. And like, I wanted to write it with that voice. I wanted to like, hey, this is wild. You're never going to believe how this thing works, because that is the reality of working with JavaScript. Like, it doesn't make on paper academic sense a lot of the time. It makes JavaScript sense, which is its own unique thing. So that was the aim for this course. Andy did complete CSS and, you know, running his own show, worked out great. I think he might have pinged me early on while I was like in the throes of a client project. And I was like, yeah. Let's do a course. Sure. And then time elapsed. And then there was definitely a DM one day that was like, when do you want to get started? And I was like, right. Yeah. And then just all in. I mean, 80,000 words later, here we are.
That definitely sounds like one of those, my split attention is writing checks and my body has trouble cashing.
100%. Yeah, absolutely.
Isn't that the story of, you know, most of our careers, really?
Yeah, the whole job for me, yeah.
Well, so this is interesting because, like, I think a lot of us, like, got to know each other on Twitter and things like that. And, like, I knew of Matt long before we ever met in real life or anything.
Whatever it was, I apologize.
No. But you're talking about writing checks your body can't cash. And like, one of the things I like about Matt is, like, he's a whole person online. He's not just posting about, like, the tech stuff, which I love. Like, I love the tech stuff, but I also love people who share their weird hobbies or whatever, you know. So I like following people like, you know, Jen Schiffer. I want to see her, like, making candles and writing quirky articles and making silly jokes and, you know, doing Twitch streams where her and Potch make fun of, like, Property Brothers, and they do, like, Property Cousins or something like that. So where all this is going is, like, I know that you were fixing motorcycle, you're into motorcycles for a while, you're posting stuff about, like, some carpentry projects that you did, and I swear I had to go look on your website to make sure that I was not wrong about this, but you got into boxing.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
So yeah, speaking of, you know, the long way around, writing checks your body can't cash. Tell me a little bit about how you got into boxing and how did that go?
Yeah, I got into boxing at, like, well past retirement age for an amateur boxer. I was 35, 36, which is, you know, I might as well have a walker with tennis balls on the feet hobbling into the gym at that point. But it was, you know, it was great. I used to do it when I was real young. I went to, like, a lousy strip mall chain gym and did some boxing. And I really liked it, but the environment wasn't great. But then, you know, the early 2010s were a heady time in the tech industry, and we were all very, very busy all of the time. You remember that was back during the responsive images saga and trying to build a career at a, you know, in a cave from a box of scraps. And I was wicked out of shape. So we tried, LMM and I, my wife, we tried, we wanted a weird workout. Like, we didn't want to just, like, I don't want to go and do push-ups to have done push-ups. Like, it's got to be for something. And if it's going to be for something, it should be, and I cannot stress this enough, stupid. So we went to circus school briefly.
All right.
It did not work out for reasons. And then I was like, okay, my turn to pick. So we walk into Boston Boxing in Brighton, and the first exercise machine I see is a big tractor tire on the floor with a larger sledgehammer with a hunk of metal welded to the side of it. And those were your options for using that workout machine. And I was like, dope, I'm in, let's do this. And then we started taking, like, the fitness classes there, you know, the someone yells at you when you do 20 pushups, et cetera.
Right.
Worked my way up to the competition team. I mean, I may not be good at much, but I am really good at getting hit in the head. And as it turns out, I was so good at it that it overcame my elderly detriment in the sport. It was fun. I only ever had one sanctioned amateur fight. It was all smokers, which is just like an exhibition match. It's called a smoker, where, like, the gym just gets a bunch of people from nearby gyms together. Some people come in, they buy, you know, a $2 can of beer out of a trash can full of ice, and everybody just kind of hits each other. And it was really great. They were a really good crew. They did a ton of charity stuff.
Which you also have been doing charity stuff recently.
I was wondering if you were going to bring it up.
Well, you gave me the opening.
That's right. This has all been a long con. This whole setup for the podcast has been so I can talk about Mega Man.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. What's Mega Man?
Story of my career. Oh, you're going to regret this. No, just an old NES series, you know, Mega Man 1 through 6 on the NES, 7 on the SNES. I'm going to stop myself right there. I just played the... Where are we at on cursing in this podcast?
We're fine.
I played the gosh darn right out of Mega Man when I was a kid. I have whatever drives a person to speedrun games, whatever gland that is, way in the back of my head that I am constantly tamping down because that will consume someone like me. But I do aspire to be a Mega Man 2 speedrunner. And I can burn that game down in like 40 odd minutes. I don't know what the world record is. If I'm mistaken on what the world record is, I'm definitely way above that. But I have been known to sit for 3 hours and just play Flashman's level over and over again to do it as quickly as I can. Okay. So, so the Mega Manathon was a marathon I did on Twitch where I ran through Mega Man 1 through 6 and Mega Man X in a single sitting for charity, for Trans Lifeline. And it was, I started at $10 per death I would donate. And for every $100 chat donated, I would up my per death rate by $1. So I ended up at a maximum of $25 per death. all told, I actually have to look it up on my very own website, which you too can do, listener, if you go to wil.to/Mega Manathon. We raised, I died 36 times, Mega Man 1 through 6 and X, and we raised a grand total of $4,000 for Trans Lifeline.
Nice.
That's great.
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
And 36 deaths across, you know, 7 games. Sounds like you might know a thing or two about those games.
But. Oh, and it was a shameful display. It was terrible. I shouldn't die in Mega Man 2. I should be able to clear 1 and 2 no deaths. Easy. But you know, the pressure was on and I don't know how to do Twitch. I'm 40 whatever years old. It's these kids with their, everything's lighting up and someone's clipping me and there's something about donating bits and I don't want bits. I've already got bits.
Yeah. But back at the beginning of the discussion about Mega Man and boxing, you mentioned the early 2010s and the heady days of responsive images.
Woof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned you did a thing for web.dev about images. Was that about responsive images or?
No, it was about all the web.dev thing was just here's as much as I can churn out about images, all the formats, all the encodings, all the JPEG is decadent and depraved. It is. Yeah, I've done a ton of images work, less so lately because it's sort of the responsive images stuff is certainly settled. But yeah, I was the chair of the RICG, the community group that brought responsive images to the web platform.
Do you want to like tell the story of that a little bit? Because I was like off to the side of that. I don't believe that I actually joined that community group. We had a different community group that I was part of at the time. But I saw a lot of the conversations, I think, that were before that, that were in like WhatWig IRC.
Yep. Yeah.
So I don't know if you would like to tell some brief version of the story because I
yeah for sure
assume everybody who's listening isn't quite as old as some of us.
I'm not sure anybody in the world is as old as me.
How many grandkids do you have?
You're only as old as you feel, Eric. Oh, okay. Which is to say, there's nobody older than me.
Fair enough.
Especially this week. Yeah. Well, it's been launch week. You know, it's busy. Yeah, before I was the chair of anything, which makes it sound a lot more formal than it was, I was working at Filament Group at the time. This was 2010, 2011.
Yeah, I think around there.
Yeah, and they had just started a project with the Boston Globe, bostonglobe.com, which was to be the big, like, Ethan Marcotte showed up because he was also a North Cambridge kid like me. He was right around the corner. So he tagged in with Filament Group to work on the Boston Globe site. And it was going to be the big proving ground site for responsive design. It was the like, can this be done at scale? So yeah, we're working on the Globe site and Scott Gell comes up with a method for just working across viewport sizes is brand new. And he determines like, hey, we're serving up images that are large enough to be appropriate for any size viewport. Means we always have to serve up the largest possible image sources. Works at large sizes, works at small sizes. The opposite is not true. To scale upwards, you get a bunch of artifacting and distortion. This is grossly efficient. If you're looking at it on a small screen. You will only ever access it by way of a small viewport. Why are we serving up a 2000 pixel wide image for a 320 pixel wide context at the time? So he came up with a pattern where setting a cookie in the head of the document meant that it would be available in time for requests that happened further down on the page. So that cookie that's set up in the head says, this screen is this big. Don't request the larger image, request this smaller one instead, to super oversimplify it. And that immediately fell apart because it was based on an assumption about how cookies and requests work.
I'm curious, why did it fall apart? Because it sounds pretty solid.
Yeah, it was prefetching. It was around a little while after the globe launched, browsers were like, hey, just parse out the sources on the page, go out and fetch them right away, and then start doing all the page stuff. And that page stuff included our logic. So we, you know, we were sort of banging our heads against like, how can we find a way to influence these requests if our code can't be executed in time to do so? And I don't know who it was, but someone was like, I don't think this is doable. I think we need markup for this. We need something baked into the browsers to handle this for us because it's a browser level concern. They're deciding when to make these requests. We have to offload that to them. So a bunch of us got together in an Etherpad. I don't know if everyone remembers Etherpads, and just started spitballing some markup. And I think it was Bruce Lawson who pitched a picture element to do some of this selective loading, the same way video and audio did, or do. And we were like, yeah, done. Check. Now we just go and tell web standards that we want this, and they make it for us. And what ensued was several years of mailing list arguments and IRC channels and getting very, very shot down and compromising over and over again, and me just continually picking the same fight. And then eventually the W3C rolled out the community groups program, which is very much aimed at like, hey, workaday developers and designers, get involved in web standards. So we did. We super did. And we immediately took it to like a pirate radio place where we were publishing drafts of a spec that did not count for anything to anyone and just sending it around like, do this one. And eventually they did do that one. We ended up with source set sizes. We ended up with the picture element for like what's called the art direction use case, where you need to say explicitly serve this based on these dimensions versus source set, which is just like, hey, get the most efficient thing from this list of potential sources. And that was sort of the RICG's journey.
There were a lot of members of RICG that went on to be very involved in web standards and a bunch of other things too. Like, I don't know how many of them were like working for vendors at the time, but
very, very few. Yeah.
Definitely like Yoav actually, Yoav Weiss got into writing browser code because of this, right? I mean, well,
that was
not necessarily in that order, but like it was like, he was crowdfunded to.
Yeah, right. I think it might have been in that order because I think we did the Indiegogo for like, we got it standardized in quotes enough that it was time for some like example implementations in browsers. But us just complaining in bug trackers wasn't enough for like WebKit or Google to haul off and do it just to see if this idea had any merit. So we did an Indiegogo to raise money to hire Yoav to implement it in Chromium, and we raised like 10 grand. We paid for like a lot of his time, and it worked. It eventually he proved it there, and it caught on from there.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's the kind of story that Brian and I love, because it's literally about grassroots developers needed a thing, and somebody, or maybe more than one somebody,
many somebody,
went through the process of shoving the rock up the hill as much as possible, right?
And
sometimes having it rolled back down a bit, like you said, and then you keep shoving it up the hill, figuring out what can be done. And then eventually, right, getting to the point of, all right, let's collect some money and hire somebody to do a thing. And they did the thing. And now, like, that's part of everybody's experience, which is pretty fantastic. There are not enough such stories, but we love that like this story is one example that does exist.
Yeah, the W3C has this notion of like community groups. You can create a community group and try to get a community together to help flesh something out and try to get some interest and things. But like Eric and I also sit on the interop committee. And I mean, I can tell you from working here at Egalia, like there's like infinity asks of the web platform, you know? And so, I mean, I was certainly a very different place in 2010, where I was like, just do the dang picture, like, just do it, like, just, you know, and it's like, okay, but there are also like 80 other or 800, 8,000 other things. People are like, just do it, just do it, you know, just do MathML, just do SVG, just do promises, just do HTML imports, just do Shadow DOM. It's hard to prioritize those things. And I really like that the Responsive Images community group were like, hey, look, we can't get it prioritized. And so we're going to organize and get it prioritized. And I feel like that was very effective. And it is kind of a shame that we don't do more of it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Another thing that was in that same domain that you were interested in and helped to try to keep instigating was container queries, right?
Yeah, that was in our exhaustion at the end of the Responsive Images saga, we were like, you know, you picture the end of the movie where the protagonist is, you know, they're bleeding and they're all bandaged up and they're like, all right, who's next? And we were like, all right, so we're going to real quick do container queries. And as it turns out, no, I didn't have it in me to keep pushing the rock up the hill. I'd already pushed one rock and buffed it nice and smooth and round. But we did, if nothing else, we at least started making noise about it. We're just like, to be clear, the RICG was full of very, very, very smart people by the hundreds. And also I was present, making a lot of noise and picking fights in IRC. And we did manage to make a lot of initial noise around container queries where it's like, hey, we need something for this. Please, we need something for this. And just like with responsive images, the pushback was immediate and ironclad. No, cannot be done. Impossible to do. The web as a platform cannot support this. So you send emails and you pick fights in IRC and you send more emails. And it at least, you know, it knocked it a little loose. We loosened the jar for everyone else to follow. And really, that's what more can one ask? They're here. They've arrived.
Right. And it's interesting to me how many things just in the last few years have started landing in browsers that for years or decades, literally, we were told
so
ironclad cannot happen. The web platform absolutely cannot support this. Browsers cannot do this. Has container queries.
Yep.
You know,
we might fix headings. Headings might be fixed.
Yeah.
Do you believe in miracles?
Literally the oldest problem for the web. Mm-hmm. Like literally, I know I say this a lot, but the very first email that Tim Berners-Lee sent on WWW Talk was like, this heading shit is not going anywhere. Like, we got to fix it.
Hey, gang, I don't know about this one.
Come on, guys.
Yeah. Well, once part of the platform, always part of the platform, which is.
Who was dumb enough to add all these numbers to these H elements?
Yes. Ugh,
what a mistake.
Goldfarb.
I mean, not to bring it back full circle to the JavaScript course, but like, That is 100% the stuff I'm touching on in there too, where it's like, hey, once this stuff hits the platform, it's there. Once it's out on the web, you get document all for the rest of your natural life. And it's always going to be the only falsy object JavaScript will ever acknowledge because of 10 days in 1995, you know?
Talk a little bit more about that. Like what's in the course? Like who's the course for?
Yeah, I also want to ask you a really specific question about the course, which is like that example that you just used is a perfect one because like, is it JavaScript like including all the DOM APIs?
No, we touch on them a little bit, but it is pretty focused JavaScript, the language as it is played. Okay. So for context, I made Andy Bell let me write what I called weirding modules, which is definitely a reference to the Dune movie directed by David Lynch, which is a good movie to me.
Okay.
Which are these little disclosure things buried in the lesson where, like, the lesson is on Booleans. It's true and false. You know, how hard could it be? 3,000 words later. And in that is a little disclosure element where I write, like, here are what the falsy values are in JavaScript. It's the empty string. It's zero. It's... And then there's a disclosure module that's like, okay, fine. There's one other thing. And then I write about the storied history of document all, where it's like, you could skip this. You don't need to know about document all to write modern JavaScript. That's what the course is focused on. Like, get to work, go from junior to senior developer is the tagline. But for you sickos out there who really want to know why non is not equal to non, here's a little side quest for you to check out. So yeah, there's a whole tirade. Like, I go on a tear about document all.
I am absolutely one of those sickos.
Oh, 100%. This is why, I don't know if all the course branding is retro, future, janky, on purpose, washed out. Like, I'm going to kick myself for saying this after. I like JavaScript because it sucks. It's a boom mic in the shot. It's got charm. It's got, like, you can see where people made it, you know? Like, there are gaps, this grid on the lens. Document all is in there forever. And, like, this is the future we imagined in the 90s. We sat down and we were like, what's the web going to be like in 2025? Let's figure it all out over a week and a half and just give it our best shot. And all of that is still locked in there. It's so weird and so, like, clunky, and you get so much creativity through constraints with JavaScript, if that makes sense. And I think we do ourselves a huge disservice by trying to, like, paper over it with layers and layers and layers of frameworks to get rid of what it is, to, like, distance arm's length the whole thing so we don't have to think about how it actually works as much. Yeah, I mean, it is the platform. It grew up alongside the web, and it is janky, and it is open by design, and it kind of works most of the time, and it's, you know, it's a little weird. And that has been my tagline, unofficially at the start, but officially by the end, is that we're going to get weird. Like, no one starts out as a capital T JavaScript developer. Like, nobody has JavaScript brain. That's not real. All the people I've ever talked to who are like, I can't do JavaScript. That's a programming language. This, I want to be like, are you kidding me? This, it can't do math. This thing's a mess. It's a clown shoes. Of course you can learn it. We can all learn it. Yeah, absolutely. And look at all the stuff you can build with this big old honking pair of clown shoes. It's great. So that's you heard it here first, folks. JavaScript, big old honking clown shoes.
I mean, and like you say, it's got charm.
It's got charm.
I had to look up because I'm bad at remembering the name of the laws. So the law I'm thinking about is Hiram's law, which is with sufficient number of users of an API, it does not matter what you promise in the contract. All observable behaviors of your system will be depended on by somebody. And that's an interesting bit about the web, is that even things that, you know, we didn't standardize, we didn't intend to write down, still end up stuck in there, you know, like,
right.
Even really weird things that, you know, people just discovered. I mean, I know most people don't think about, like, the iteration order of property keys and things like that, but, right. There was diligently reverse engineered copying of that and until it became necessary. Do you have a lot of other examples like that are in the book? That I find those things just really fun.
Oh, I just, you know, I was just going to say, for all the time I have spent cursing the array constructor. And it's like, why have they done this to me personally? Why have they visited this slight upon me professionally? Yeah, it's the alternative is, if stuff gets fixed, we burn the library of GeoCities. Like, everybody that relied on this janky old thing before anybody knew any better way back when. I don't mind eating the cost of remembering that something's a little weird for the sake of long-term longevity of websites I have never seen and will never see, that the authors completely forgot about, that are just kicking around on some Zanga someplace. That's great. I love that stuff, man. What a part to be able to play in that. Just remembering that array is weird, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to throw in an XKCD 1172. Every change breaks someone's workflow.
Oh, yeah. Hometown hero, Randall Monroe, in a way.
Okay.
Yeah, the famous XKCD, which you are now going to have to put in show notes. I apologize. Where the dream coordinates appear.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a park where I used to play at as a kid, North Cambridge. Oh, cool. He lived for a long time right in my old stomping grounds where I grew up. A bunch of people went there on the designated date to the designated coordinates. And I guess it got real weird. I was not present.
So I feel like I got to follow you before you went to Boku. I know like there were a couple of events that we wound up together, and I really liked listening to you speak. I think you were speaking about performance at the time.
Yeah, I was. I had a talk on responsive images, and then I had a couple of talks year over year about just general front end performance stuff. One of which was at an event apart, which was big career goal to speak at an event apart in Boston. Eric, you remember, you were there.
I was there.
Did you come to Pittsburgh for Abstractions one year?
Yes.
I think I think you were here in my stomping ground for that.
Yeah, Liza Gardner was supposed to speak.
Right.
And had to bow out last minute.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't you, was it? Somebody was like, hey, do you want to give a talk? And I was like,
yeah, I believe it was me, it actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, right. Do what now? Yeah, sure. Because, I mean, again, what a time. What a time for the industry. Where I was just like, sure, I got a talk ready to go. Let's do this.
Right.
Yeah, that was good. That was a good show.
Yeah, it was really good, actually. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Where did you learn your JavaScript? Like, how did you pick it up? Oof. I mean, for me, I got the JavaScript Bible, you know, the Rhino book, and I watched a lot of things over the years. I read what I could of the ECMA spec. I was involved in a lot of the like ECMA mailing lists and things like that.
Yeah.
But I remember seeing like a lot of really good talks over the years by like Doug Crockford, or like Brendan gave some good talks. How did you learn about?
Oh, just working in the semicolon mines, just faking it until I made it. I mean, I started with, you know, career sponsored by Stack Overflow, where I was just grabbing snippets of jQuery and dropping them in and wondering whether they would or would not work when I reloaded the page. I was very faking it when I got started in the industry. I lied my way into my first internship by saying I was picking up projects on Craigslist just because I was like, I guess I can make a website, having done it a couple of times. Maybe there's a job here. And one of them was to install PHP BB for someone. So I did it. And they emailed me, the client emailed me after and was like, hey, is there any chance we're looking to hire our first intern? Are you a college student and are you looking for an internship? And I was like, oh yeah, big time, 100%. Please give me a job with a chair. I was not a college student. I have never been to college. I did not need an internship. But by the time I revealed it to them, I had already been there long enough that I'd figured out how to do the job. And it just played out from there. It was just keep on trucking, get to the point where I could read through Eloquent JavaScript and get like 15% of it. And then revisit it in a year and get 20% of it. And then, you know.
So a lot of your, like, the quirks and the weirdnesses, they're sharp edges that you cut yourself against.
Oh, yeah. And at the time, I didn't know. I was just like, yeah, this is just, I mean, I pasted it in there and it seems like it works. A good way to sum it up is that that's a little bit what I want to give back to newer devs now with the course. Not sharp edges specifically, but like, if you're just slinging React all day, you don't see a lot of the grit in there. And that is fundamentally how it all works. That is like, as much as we joke about it being janky and broken, that is the language. That is how it functions. So yeah, a little, let's say, controlled exposure to some of that deep down jank and how the gears mesh, I think is important. I think it's important for learning the language to know what's going on in there. Yeah, but that is absolutely, no question in my mind, I used Document All at some point, and I can't recall when or where specifically, but if it was somewhere on the internet in a way I could copy and paste it, I probably used it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was, you know, at the time it was really, really useful. But there's like all kinds of other things that are very easy to cut yourself on when you don't know, that are sort of hidden landmines, oh, I guess, yeah. You know.
Math, any arithmetic for floating point.
Exactly.
And I'm not confident enough in my own ability to do math that, like, when I would do stuff and it would come back with the number wrong, I'd be like, what have I done? How in the world did I do this? You know,
I think also the way that you can, any ID that you've declared becomes like a global variable. You don't even have to say document get element by ID. It will just be there. That's incredibly strange. And
or as a key for document all. It's one of my favorites. I almost didn't write about it. And then Mike Panisi, who I worked with at Boku, mm-hmm. was my tech editor on this. Best in the game. Hands down, best JavaScripter I know, left a comment on something unrelated that was like, you have to do document all. And I was like, do I want to get into all of that for these poor, unsuspecting, do I want to mold young minds in that way? And like, yeah, of course I do. Yeah, it's wild in there. Welcome to JavaScript.
Yeah, I mean, I love that we have things that are teaching this, because one of the things that I think makes people give up is when they find something that just like they're like, I have no idea what just happened, you know, like and that's really frustrating. So I really appreciate courses that, you know, point to the thing that you might accidentally stab yourself with and say, maybe don't stab yourself with that. Beware, mm-hmm. there's a mm-hmm. sharp pointy bit there, don't stab yourself.
Yeah, I've never been a big like Dark Souls guy, but I feel like that's effectively what the course is for JavaScript, is me leaving messages that are like, big boss ahead. Watch out.
It's dangerous to go alone. Take this.
Exactly right. I'm currently obsessed with Hollow Knight Silksong, so it's dangerous to go anywhere and do anything in that game. Mm. God, what a good game. Sorry, no video games. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're well past that point now.
Yeah, story of my life.
So you said document.all. Did you touch on document.write?
I did not.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, well, and see, this is one of those things where I'm like, I don't want to give anybody ideas. I don't want to do a don't stick peas up your nose, if you're familiar with that adage, where a parent says to a child, whatever you do, don't stick peas up your nose. And the kid says, I never thought of that. But this, God, where do you draw the line? You know, I mean, I ended up at, we were originally planning for 60,000 words and I ended up at 80,000.
That's not so bad. And
yeah. And it's still, I'm still kicking myself. There's so much I didn't get to. And I ended up in the week before launch writing a whole module about the entirety of asynchronous JavaScript.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, I can't let this go out and just be like, so JavaScript is a language constrained by linear time. So I did a whole bit where I introduced myself at the start of that module at the end of the course. I concluded the this is spoilers for the course. I concluded the previous module with like, now the course is over. Thanks so much for your time. Started the one on asynchronous JavaScript by introducing myself and then interrupting myself mid-introduction. Like, wait, how did I get here? I'm not supposed to be here unless he set it up. So that this module, because I'm writing this first, he probably put this at the end as a meta bit. You got to make your own fun, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely, 100%. Mm-hmm. Most of my demos are me telling jokes to myself that
exactly.
literally nobody else will get. So yeah, at least your jokes other people will get. So well done.
Well, I don't know. I insisted that Andy build a air horn button at the end of the course. Spoilers, but there's a button you can press to just blast people with an air horn, because I warned people I was going to do it a bunch of times. I left block quotes open for Mike Panisi to make fun of me for the tech editing process. I was like, a lot of people will confuse arguments and parameters, just the terminology. One is used here, one is used there. I am going to mess this up a bunch of times. Here is an empty space for Mike to make fun of me for doing exactly that. You got to play with the medium, you know? Mm. What are we doing? It's the web.
You got to make your own fun, like you said.
Got to make your own fun.
I mean, I personally get more from like a course or instructor or a writer who engages me somehow to keep me interested. So I feel like That's really good, actually.
That was the goal. And like, there's a time and a place for the web.dev, like super dry reference materials. Here's what you need to know about what an iterator is, full stop.
But then there are other places.
Then there's this course. Yeah. A different thing altogether.
Speaking of carpentry, over the weekend, I unboxed my new combination belt and disc sander from Wen.
Mm-hmm.
And the packing and unpacking list at the beginning of the instructions says unpacking with the help of a friend or trustworthy foe, such as one of your in-laws.
Wow. Like, they're making their own fun, you know?
Somebody check in with the instruction writer, see if everything's okay at home.
Yeah, someone showed up at work Monday morning. They had a surprise email. They've got a slight hangover, and they're like, yeah, you know what? Fine. Let's have fun with it. Yep, I get it.
Yeah, having that voice, always useful.
Yeah.
Like, people notice, so.
Right. Which, I mean, for a topic like JavaScript, I think there's a time and a place for a little of that, because it is like fundamentally ridiculous in a lot of ways. And for sure you want the dry rev. Like, the MDN is doing a better job than I could ever hope to do explaining all the parts of JavaScript, all the component parts. But like, you get to the end of some of that and you're like, what? And that goes unanswered. And so my goal for voice and tone was to be like, all right, listen, I know. Here's our best guess at why. It is like this, though. And at least at the end, it's like, okay, I guess it's just like that, which, yes, it is. Spoilers for the course. It is just like that.
Yeah. So a few times now you've said that JavaScript is fundamentally ridiculous, which, no argument for me.
Yeah. I mean, samesies, to be real.
But right. So maybe that's why it calls to you. But
that could be it. Yeah. Neither of us make any sense. Neither of us can do math.
Yeah. So other than sort of the obvious things like not being able to do math, what's a good example of fundamental ridiculousness?
Oh, it's just the stuff with the fingerprints on it, like that the array constructor works as a constructor if you don't invoke it with new. And it's like, sure. Yeah. And it can't ever be changed. And it's because, you know, a person made that decision at some point somewhere. And it's like, you expect, if you're brand new to it, someone says it's a programming language, and you're just thinking it's this like cold clinical, the Borg are here situation. And it's what's so imposing. Once you're intermediate at JavaScript, you at least get the gist of it and you've learned the rules of it. There are so many places where the rules do not apply. And it's like, I just got here. Like, what are we doing? Yeah, it's that's the specific ridiculousness inflection point for JavaScript, is once you've learned the rules, once you've got a handle on how it works, then you start learning all the ways that it does not work the way it works, you know? Okay. And that to me is the ridiculousness of it.
Mm. And I like the fingerprints thing. CSS has a lot of that.
Oh, yeah.
As well, where a lot of times the answer to the question, why is it like this, is because at a working group meeting, there was a morning in late 2000 where the working group was just like, well, this is how we think it's going to go. So,
well, there's also that, you know, in any of these, whether it's CSS working group or TC39 or whatever, like, we're just a bunch of individuals who are often speculating what developers will find intuitive. And, you know,
yeah, we're just meat that electrocutes itself to move around, man. What are we doing making decisions about how programming languages work?
Yeah, but I mean, surprisingly, there isn't one answer to that question, right?
Right.
I mean, if you have a question that you think, I definitely know what everybody thinks about this, and then you run a poll on it,
you'll
find that you're wrong.
Right. And for all you know, the poll is also wrong. It is some secret third thing, you know? And true. That is... Yeah, we've been building the plane in the air since, I don't know, 1993 or whatever.
Yeah. So the flip side of the fundamental ridiculousness, you said you would regret saying that you like JavaScript.
I do.
Like, what's something something in specific that you like about it, or that you found that you liked in the course of writing this course?
Oh boy. That's tough. Because I am the sicko that the weirding modules are for. So I've sort of given up the game there by saying I like the weird things. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I hadn't. Because again, and this is not a confession. I mostly put borders on stuff for a living. I write a lot of click the button, something happens JavaScript, which is not a knock. That is absolutely what I do for a living. So I don't get a lot of time to like tinker with iterators. And that was something I had to write and rewrite a couple of times because I was like, I'm missing something. There's something about this I'm missing. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, even for me, it's sort of by the end of it, I was like, got it, locked it in. This is satisfying. This is strange. Like it calls for shifts in thinking that the human brain doesn't necessarily jump right to. But once you got it, it's locked in. You understand this and you know this is how, this is not just how iterators work. This is how iterables work. This is how all iterables work. This is how every array and every array like works. And that's, there is something very satisfying about that in a, this is going to sound wild, in a Sonic the Hedgehog design documents way. Yes. So when they were making Sonic the Hedgehog, from my understanding, the main thing they wanted to capture and the reason the movement in the game is the way it is, where you're actually pretty slow and it takes a long time to like build up momentum and the jump is super floaty, is because they wanted to optimize the game design for that feeling of going fast. Like those relatively rare segments in Sonic the Hedgehog where you're just tearing across the screen, no control over anything that's happening. And then it stops you again and it makes you like slow down and do a bunch of deliberate platforming. Learning about, boy, what a wild metaphor. Learning about iterators is a lot like the slow parts of the platforming in Sonic the Hedgehog. Where once you get through that, once you get to the end, the way is clear. It's like, oh, I don't just get this. I get a bunch of other stuff that I didn't even know I didn't get. That is so satisfying. Like so many hedgehogs, I gotta go fast. And that to me is the peak of JavaScript Mountain, is when something locks in a place and it's like, I get a bunch of stuff. I can tear through this now.
I'm constantly thinking about this, like, how are we doing and how do we measure how we're doing? So, you know, when I hear you say like, it's weird, you know, we have a lot of people working on TC39 and they do get into esoteric arguments and debates and things like that.
Sure.
And it's like, sometimes I wonder like, you know, are the results coming out of it good? Are they better? Are they worse? And the answer is like, yes, they are better and they are worse. And
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is like the number of weird tangents definitely is reduced as the course goes on, starting from like, here's what a primitive is to here's how to extend classes. Things get a lot more uniform and let's say sensible, but still like static initialization blocks. It's like, all right, even here in the future, I can see how people got there. It makes a sense, certainly. I don't disagree with it, but, you know, so even the modern additions to the language, it's still a little, but that is still, as the course goes on, as we get into classes, it's like, okay, welcome to perma strict mode. What a time to be alive. Everything you've learned so far about how it's good in strict mode and different not in strict mode, you can rest a little assured. There's a progress toward making more and more conventional definition sense. But yeah, still, you can still see the fingerprints. You know, it is still decisions made by people, and famously, people make some decisions.
They sure do.
Sure do.
Well, I would love to just keep this going forever,
yeah.
But we all got places to go, things to do, people to run over. So, especially you live in Boston. So,
I have a car, but I pedestrianize whenever I can. You know, there's just no sense in it here.
I think we've mentioned, but let's wrap up by saying, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm Wilto every place. So like Blue Sky, I'm WIL.to. My website is WIL.to, which is probably the best focal point for seeing what I'm up to. The course, JavaScript for Everyone, is at wil.to/js. Or if you want to challenge yourself to spell the word Piccalilli right on the first try, Piccalilli/JavaScript for Everyone. With hyphens in it. You know what? It's wil.to/js.
Yeah. Let's hear it for homebrewed URL shorteners.
Oh, yeah. I think it's just a redirect I have set up somewhere. It's not like I know how to make a website, you know?
I mean,
anyone?
Yeah, honestly, who does?
So, right, exactly.
Anyway, Matt, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for having me.